When I was in high school, I read for the first time Shirley Jackson's great short story called The Lottery. And most people in high school in America read it, so you might remember the plot. It's about a festive gathering in a small American sort of town in the heartland. And it's summertime, and there's good food, and there's music and festivity. And it soon becomes clear that at the heart of all this is a lottery. And you assume that whoever the winner is going to get some great prize. But then the story, as it progresses, darkens quite a bit. And then we discover that when the winner, in quotes, is chosen, she reacts with great fear, protesting the injustice of it all, as the townspeople close in on her with rocks and stones in hand. And the story ends with their coming upon her to stone her to death. A story that still haunts me to this day. Anyone that's read it, I think, has that reaction. Now go back to the pre-Columbian Aztec civilization. Aztecs would choose a handsome and brave warrior from a rival tribe, maybe someone they'd captured in war. For a year, they would wine him and dine him. They would treat him like a celebrity. They'd dress him up in the best clothes. At the end of the year, he'd be marched to the top of a pyramid where he'd be sacrificed and his still beating heart taken out and offered to the gods. Go back now to ancient Rome, and we find most famously in the Colosseum, but other settings as well, gladiators engaging in hand-to-hand combat to the death, to the entertainment of the mobs. And we know these games were used very cynically by the political powers to manipulate the masses and to control them, et cetera, et cetera. Then go way back to ancient Greek mythology and the story of Theseus and the Minotaur. Remember, it was the king of Athens was obliged by the king of Crete, who had defeated him, that every year he had to send in tribute seven young men, seven young women, to Crete, and they were brought into the labyrinth, this great maze, and they had to do battle with the Minotaur. And of course, they were all killed. They were sacrificed essentially to the Minotaur until Theseus finds a way to make his way through the maze, kill the Minotaur, and make his way out, and he kind of undoes this practice. Okay, why am I mentioning all this? Well, because of the most popular movie right now in America called The Hunger Games, and I knew nothing about Hunger Games till about a month ago. I was on a plane coming home from the West Coast, and there was a guy next to me reading this book, The Hunger Games, reading it with great interest, and I thought, I wonder what that is. And then after that, I saw everywhere ads, Hunger Games, everywhere. So I knew I had to go see this movie, which is based on these wildly popular novels that appealed to, I guess, young people largely, but more broadly as well. As I watched The Hunger Games, all I could think of were all these antecedents of stories of human sacrifice and the reality of human sacrifice in our history. So, for example, the lottery. There's a great lottery at the beginning of The Hunger Games where in this post-apocalyptic America, it's now divided into 12 districts. And each district has to send young people to the capital city, and they're going to engage in this mortal combat. Well, they're chosen by lottery, so that reminded me of Shirley Jackson's story. Well, then these a young man and a young woman, it's a bit like the Theseus story there, young man and young woman are chosen, and they're taken by special train to the capital city. And there they are treated like celebrities. And they are wined and dined, they're dressed in fancy clothes, they're given special training in media, and they are the ultimate celebrities of the society. They're on the most popular talk show. Well, that reminded me vividly, of course, of the Aztec story of the victim who's prepared during a long year as a celebrity, and then he's put to death. The Roman connections are made very clearly in the story, as these games, these battles to the death, are performed for the whole country through television. And they become the riveting drama the entire country is watching. Furthermore, the government, and it's Donald Sutherland who plays, you know, the president, is clearly using them to manipulate, control, dominate the populace, so very much like ancient Rome. A lot of the style and even the language of the movie, too, is evocative of ancient Rome. And then finally, the Theseus story, as I mentioned, with the young men and young women having to come and basically make their way through this dreadful challenge until, in this case, there's this couple. The rules are bent a little bit. I won't give the whole movie away, but this couple kind of undermines the whole process and undoes it. You know. So anyway, all that was sort of floating around in my head as I watched this rather compelling story. But here's what kept coming back to me. Why is it that this dynamic of human sacrifice is so dominant in our culture, in our fiction, but also in our behavior from ancient times to the present day? Why is this dynamic so dominant? And again, here I go back to, I think, one of the great intellectual players in the late 20th and early 21st century, namely René Girard, who's the French literary theorist, who uncovered this dynamic. He did it through his study of Dostoevsky and Shakespeare and many others, but discovered what he called the scapegoating mechanism. And in a word, tensions arise within human communities rather naturally. What do we do to solve the problem? By this mechanism, and that word suggests it's largely unconscious, by this mechanism we choose someone to blame, someone to isolate, someone to ostracize, at the limit, someone to kill. And we discharge our anxiety, our tension, our fears onto that person or that group. In that process, Girard says, we come to a kind of peace, which is precisely why this activity is sanctioned so often by the state and by religion. Why there's a religious overtone. Again, think of the Aztecs there as a good example. It's surrounded by religion. The Romans as well, you know. The lottery in its own way, too. Think of you know, religious sacrifice to the gods, all of that. So Girard says that's why it's given this sanction. But then he discovered something else. He was, you know, born and raised a Catholic, but kind of had lost his faith. But rediscovered it when he read the Bible. Because in the Bible he saw, yes, indeed, this whole dynamic is on display. The Bible knows it as well as Shakespeare and Dostoevsky. But the Bible also shows the way out. Because at the heart of the New Testament revelation, the climax of the whole Bible, you find indeed a scapegoated victim. Caiaphas says, wouldn't it be better for one man to die than for the whole nation to be destroyed? There's the voice of scapegoating violence from ancient times to the present day. But in this case, God is not sanctioning that act. In fact, God is identified with the scapegoated victim. In that, the scapegoating mechanism is unveiled, hence the revelation of Christianity for Girard. It's unveiled and it's sort of disempowered. And now a new vision of life emerges that's based upon not scapegoating violence, but based upon love and forgiveness and compassion and connection, and especially identification with the victim. That's really interesting about the Hunger Games. I'll have to give away a bit of the ending here, I suppose, but these two young people who effectively resist the momentum toward scapegoating violence. They, in a funny way, don't play the game. Now, it's deeply disconcerting to the powers that be, and that's very clear in the movie, and that's right, because the state will depend upon this move. But these two young people are operating, you might say, out of a more Christian worldview. Now, here's the last thought, and this was striking me all through the movie. The society in the Hunger Games is a futuristic society, so it's sometime in the future. We assume a very sophisticated, and we see that in the capital city. Everyone's very, you know, high-level sophistication. The Aztec civilization was a very sophisticated civilization. Roman civilization, one of the most advanced, sophisticated we've ever seen. All of those, now this is fictional and non-fictional, but all of those were compatible with human sacrifice. Human sacrifice emerged right, in fact, at the heart of those civilizations. See, I think we comfort ourselves or flatter ourselves and we say, oh, that could never happen now. No, old times. I like the fact that the Hunger Games is set in a futuristic society where human sacrifice has reemerged. And see, I would argue what keeps human sacrifice at bay is none other than Christianity, is this great religion that says no to scapegoating violence, that unmasks it, that identifies with the victim. That's the system of thought, and we might be going on its fumes right now. I mean, we are to some degree a post-Christian society, but we're still going on the fumes of a Christian civilization. God help us if that totally fades away. Because I think it's altogether possible that in the midst even of a very sophisticated civilization, something like human sacrifice could reemerge. And that's why, you know, I wonder if this movie, in an odd way, is prophetic. And very disturbingly so.